Calling it a clear and present danger to Texas's biggest city, the mayor of Houston cancels the upcoming Texas Republican Convention. Details and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. As metro areas sound alarms over the rise of coronavirus cases, few counties have been as hard hit as one in a remote part of Northeast Texas. The view from Titus County. Also, in a state that likes to toot its horn as number one, new numbers from the census are nothing to brag about. Why Texas ranks near the bottom in an important census year metric and what that could add up to. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this Thursday, the 9th of July. I'm David Brown. Hope your day has been a good one so far. Been quite an eventful 24 hours. COVID-19 cases have reached such a level that the numbers of deaths in Texas and Florida over the past month, more than 2,000, exceeds the number of people lost in all the hurricanes in the past 20 years combined, according to a report from Newsweek. Texas and four other states set new single-day records for new coronavirus cases yesterday. And as this was going on, the presidents of the United States and Mexico were meeting in Washington to celebrate the new USMCA trade deal, an event that seemed to get little attention from the U.S. media except for the raising of eyebrows on social media. As Andres Manuel López Obrador compared his U.S. counterpart favorably to Presidents Lincoln and Washington, and as President Trump called AMLO a cherished friend, foregoing the denigrations and insults he has used in the past against Mexico and migrants from President López Obrador's country. The warm words between the two were characterized by Al Jazeera as an odd bromance. Speaking of raising eyebrows and closer to home, Houston's mayor did something yesterday he'd seemed somewhat reluctant to do until now, given the political dimensions of the move, but citing health considerations, Mayor Sylvester Turner canceled the Texas Republican Party convention set to begin in Texas's biggest city next week. Houston's health authority calling the event, quote, a clear and present danger to the health and well-being of Houstonians. Brandon Rottinghouse tracks politics in Texas as an author and political science professor at the University of Houston. Professor, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks, David.
I think a lot of people were surprised by this move somewhat. How was Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner able to cancel the state GOP convention?
Yeah, it was a bit of a slow-moving phenomenon. It was something that was probably a long time coming and was going to happen eventually given the complications with the virus. But the short answer is that effectively that Houston First, which is the nonprofit that serves as the city's convention arm, was the kind of impetus to shut it down, thinking that there was effectively a serious epidemic problem and that if the convention was allowed to go forward, it was going to be worse. Sylvester Turner was involved because there was discussion and debate for weeks leading up to it as to whether or not he would take his authority or at least his position to be able to shut down the convention. He had offered opportunities to move the convention online and effectively tried to work with the party, but it was, at least in general, the Republican Party's sense that having an in-person convention was better for them.
So why was he so reluctant initially? I mean, there could have been, it seems to me, perhaps less disruption had this decision been made several days ago.
Yeah, and that's what Republicans are saying, that this is politically motivated and that if it was made weeks ago, it would have effectively saved the effort and a lot of the hullabaloo. But I think that what the mayor wanted to avoid was the perception that this was politically motivated, that he would be on banner headlines saying that, Democratic mayor shuts down Republican Party convention in his city. That's an obvious political dynamic that's part of this, but not fully it. And the mayor, as he noted, says that there are more important things than politics and that the spread of the virus in Houston, which has been a hot spot for the outbreak, needed to be limited. But Republicans were really looking for a fight on this, standing in the street at high noon waiting for a showdown, and they eventually got it.
I guess the question from that perspective is, why did the state Republican Party insist on wanting to go forward with this convention, given all the warnings, given the fact that Houston remains one of the hottest hotspots in the Lone Star State when it comes to the spread of the coronavirus?
Obviously, the party was split on this question. It wasn't that uniformly they all wanted to because they took a vote and not everybody was on favor. But for the people who wanted to go forward and for the activists who were the most aggressive on it, the optics are important for the party. The most conservative activists in the party don't believe the virus is as dangerous as health officials say, or at the very least that the media hype sensationalizes the problem. That's in keeping with something like 70%+ of extremely conservative Republicans who think that making the economy better and putting it back on track is more important than controlling the spread of the virus.
But it also seems that that very stand had been undercut by the fact that in recent days it was made clear that a lot of the state's top leaders who were going to be speaking at the convention were going to be doing so remotely, right?
Yeah, have the convention, but we're not going to come. Right? Yeah. It obviously, you know, echoed some of the conflicting issues that I think Republicans are trying to face here, not just from a health perspective, from a political perspective, too. And as you say, you know, there's been divide. So that Dan Crenshaw tweeted that this was probably for the best and a prudent move for public health. So it's not the case that all Republicans wanted to have this. But for the optics of it, for the symbolic need to be able to show that there's unity amongst this and that there's more important things in the virus, Republicans had to make this happen. Because if this election is going to be about the coronavirus and its sort of handling from Republicans, then that creates all kinds of complications for them winning in November.
Just briefly, you mentioned Crenshaw's reaction. How are others in the Republican Party reacting?
Well, not everybody is as favorable. So Dan Patrick was on Fox News saying that this was a political hack job by Mayor Turner. So you've got, obviously, a range of different issues. The convention is considering moving in person someplace else to Montgomery County, perhaps just north of Houston. The county judge there has welcomed them with open arms. But this is also a county that is in censured the sitting governor, who is a Republican. So their sort of internal fighting continues, and the fight over this convention is part of that.
Brandon Rodinghouse is a political science professor at the University of Houston. Brandon, always a pleasure.
You too, David. Thanks.
In Northeast Texas, there's a state house district that's considered safe for Republicans, but it's not necessarily safe for the Republican incumbent right now. As we continue our focus on runoff primaries with early voting underway, Mark Haslett of KETR in Commerce brings us the story of the GOP primary runoff election in State House District 2, where the incumbent is facing his toughest opponent yet.
The East Texas town of Canton is known for its giant flea market. Locals call it the world's largest. Vendors converge here once a month to sell their goods. But lately, Canton's been attracting people for another kind of gathering, candidate forums, where two conservative Republicans have been selling themselves as the best representative for this rural district about an hour east of Dallas.
We have to be prepared for what's coming. You've been watching on your television. You've watched what the Democrats have been doing to our president. This is a different time. And we're not going to stop them with a go-along-to-get-along attitude.
That's the challenger, Brian Slayton. He's middle-aged and has his own financial services company. The incumbent who's defending the seat is Dan Flynn.
I have delivered the will of the district time and time again. I'm solidly pro-life and an author of the heartbeat bill. I have continued my fight to protect the fire, police, teacher, and municipal employees' pension from being taken away from them, as was many attempts to.
Flynn is a retired banker turned rancher. He's in his 70s. Flynn has held the office since 2003. This is actually the third time Slayton has challenged Flynn. In the primary this past March, Flynn finished first, but fell short of the majority he needed to win the nomination. So now the two are in a primary runoff election.
The most noteworthy factor is that it's very rare that incumbents get forced into runoffs. And it's also rare that incumbents have such strong challenges.
That's Mark Jones with Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. The dynamic in this race has happened before in Texas Republican Party primaries over the past decade. A long-sitting conservative legislator has his conservative credentials called into question by an insurgent challenger.
And while Flynn is conservative, he's in the middle of the pack for the Texas House delegation. And so in the eyes of many movement conservatives, he's too centrist, he's too pragmatic, and they want a more dyed-in-the-wool type Freedom Caucus person, such as Brian Slayton.
The Texas Freedom Caucus is a group of House Republicans from the right wing of the GOP. It doesn't include Flynn, who's been critical of the group. Still, both Flynn and Slayton are evangelical Christians. Both favor a pro-gun owner interpretation of the Second Amendment. Both are strong opponents of abortion. So, where do they differ? Mark Jones of the Baker Center.
Flynn is more likely to want to have the legislature focus on bread and butter issues, things like education, transportation, health care, where Slayton will be more likely to want to push some of the more red meat issues for the base, things like constitutional carry, fewer requirements related to vaccinations and the like.
Slayton has the backing of the influential right-wing group Empower Texans, which funds primary challengers to Republicans the group sees as insufficiently conservative.
I'm Brian Slayton. I would appreciate your vote in the primary. Go to my Facebook or go to brianslayton.com. Thank you very much.
Flynn, meanwhile, has his biggest support from the Texas Association of Realtors.
Got a lot of realtors right here that support the lobby. Got a lot of teachers that do. I'm a strong advocate of public education. And I would like to continue serving you as I have done. God bless you. Thank you.
If Slayton wins, it wouldn't be the first time an incumbent Republican in this part of the state was defeated from the right. Flynn has so far weathered the anti-incumbent sentiment, but this primary runoff will be his toughest fight yet. In Commerce, this is Mark Haslett.
The Texas Standard's Michael Marks is in for Wells Dunbar, monitoring social media on this Thursday. Hello there, Michael.
Hey, David. As we heard at the top of the show, the state's in-person GOP convention, a no-go in Houston, pending legal action by the Republican Party, I suppose. Two general camps of reaction to this on social media, David. One set is like this one from Rafi Omar in Houston, who tweets, "Thank you, Mayor Sylvester Turner. Governor Abbott, if Tokyo can cancel the Olympics because of the pandemic, surely you can cancel the convention this year. People's health comes first." The other is like this one from Brian Parks in Magnolia, who writes that this is all about politics. If it was a Democratic convention, there wouldn't be a word said. Also wanted to add this from Dan Crenshaw, a Houston representative that Professor Rodinghouse noted said it was a prudent move to cancel the convention. He added that this way, the Texas GOP will not be on the hook for $500,000 for canceling the event, as they would have been if they had to do it themselves.
Michael Marks is monitoring the talk of Texas. He'll be back in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. A few minutes ago, we mentioned the early voting and the runoff election. That window ends Friday with the final day to cast ballots next Tuesday. It's not just a test for Democrats and Republicans vying to be on the November ballot, but as KERA's Brett Jaspers reminds us, it's also a serious test for election procedures and processes as the state braces to conduct a fall general election amidst a pandemic.
One of the more popular voting locations in Tarrant County is at a JPS Health Center in Fort Worth. Workers in scrubs go in and out, people are picking up prescriptions, and the dumpster gets emptied. And there's also a steady trickle of people here for early voting. People like Nathaniel Aranda of Fort Worth. He and his wife made a commitment to vote no matter what, but she sent him out solo.
She just kind of wanted me to scope it out to kind of see how it is. We have a 2-month-old at home, so and a 5-year-old, so we're wanting to make sure, again, all the precautions are in place.
Aranda said voting was easy and safe. Same with Katie Abraham of Fort Worth.
There was lots of hand sanitizer in there. There was markings on the floor where you were supposed to stand. Everybody was covered with a shield. Everything was very hygienic.
At least for these early birds, voting in the time of COVID was no big deal.
I think people adjust. They adjust.
Loretta Hardiman is the lead clerk at this polling site. She's been doing this for 28 years and says things have been going swimmingly. They wipe down voting machines every half hour or so and sanitize any stylus pens people use, although communicating can be harder now.
A lot of times people can't understand you with the mask on. It's hard for them to hear you. It's hard to relate.
The primary runoff was postponed from May over coronavirus concerns, but since then, the pandemic has only spread further in Texas. Grace Chemaine is the president of the League of Women Voters of Texas. She sees this as a dress rehearsal for November.
We want to encourage as many people to vote now as possible and practice voting during the coronavirus to let us know where the issues are so we can nip them in the bud right now.
Chemaine hasn't heard of any troubles so far at polls around the state. She's particularly watching how curbside voting plays out. It's something state law says counties must provide for people who can't enter a polling place.
My concern is that curbside voting is going to be a little chaotic, and I hope that the polling places have learned how to provide that this week.
If you don't need curbside, don't use it, because you're taking it away from the people who actually need it.
Hyder Garcia is Tarrant County's elections administrator. He said curbside voting is for exceptional situations only, but it hasn't been a problem. In fact, Garcia said turnout numbers are up this time. In-person turnout in Tarrant County is already more than double what it was for the 2016 runoff. That could be because of the virus, a longer early voting period, or a nonpartisan ballot item in his county, the city of Fort Worth's proposition to extend a sales tax that funds police. Garcia, however, says a smooth election now is partly because there are just a few things on the ballot. It'll take people much longer to vote in November.
And so we're looking at, you know, distribution of machines, adding equipment, you know, how do we keep those wait times short?
Garcia says he hasn't struggled to find poll workers willing to interact with the public amid a pandemic. Leanne Rodriguez is a new clerk at the JPS polling site. She was a little scared about the virus at first before she saw ample sanitation and mask wearing. It's important to the election process that there are enough clerks, she said.
We don't want people standing in line for 8 hours like they've done in other places, so I think it's important to be here and not be scared of COVID, but be very cautious and very clean.
Early voting ends Friday for the primary runoff, and Election Day is Tuesday. I'm Brett Jaspers in Fort Worth.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. On Wednesday, auditors hired by Facebook reported that the company had not done enough to address disinformation and hate speech on its platforms. This on the heels of a meeting a day earlier between Facebook leaders and civil rights groups who pressed their demands as part of the Stop Hate for Profit campaign, an advertising boycott that's been backed by major brands including Ford, Verizon, and Starbucks. They and dozens of others have pulled their ads from Facebook, at least temporarily. Tech expert Omar Gallaga has been following this boycott, and he's here to give us an update. Hey there, Omar.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me on.
Tell us a little bit more about this meeting on Tuesday. Who was there? How did it go?
Well, this was a Zoom meeting, of course. It was with Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, a chief operating officer Sheryl Sandberg, and as you mentioned, but quite a few groups from Color of Change, including the Anti-Defamation League, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, as part of this Stop Hate for Profit campaign. And they have been able to convince hundreds of companies, small businesses to big companies like Unilever and Best Buy, to at least pause their advertising for the time being on Facebook.
And I know that there has been such turbulence that some companies, I believe Coca-Cola might be one of them, they've stopped all social media advertising. What demands has the actual boycott campaign, however, made of Facebook?
Well, the group has made a list of 10 demands of Facebook's leaders. One of the most significant ones is hiring a top executive who has a civil rights background, someone at Facebook who would kind of be in charge of that part, and also submitting to regular audits, updating their community standards. And Facebook has made some movements on this. They've said that is one thing that they would be willing to do is hire an executive with a civil rights background. But everything else is a little bit up for grabs, and a lot of people who were part of that meeting came away feeling that it was just a lot of spin, a lot of talk, and that they're not very confident that Facebook is actually going to act on all of these demands.
How unusual is it that you have so many advertisers, I understand dozens got involved in June, fully on board with a boycott campaign like this led by civil rights organizations?
In the social media age, I've never seen anything this big. I've never seen this many advertisers at one time pause or pull advertising over an issue. It's kind of unprecedented in social media that they would get that many large companies to take another look. And I think it's just part of this cultural moment that all of these companies feel they have to do something, and this is one way that they feel they can take some action.
What about other platforms with a history of contentious speech policies? I'm thinking of Twitter, for example. Are advertisers boycotting Twitter as well?
They are, but I don't think they're getting the same kind of vehemence that Facebook is, because Twitter and for instance, Snapchat have actually moved to take some steps to label incendiary posts, to even posts by the president have been labeled by Twitter and Snapchat as either untruthful or as something that could be inciting hate speech, and they've gotten a lot of blowback for that. So they have been boycotted by some of these companies. Some of that boycott has spread to particularly Twitter, but also they have taken more steps than Facebook has. So they've gotten a little less of the brunt of the outrage than Facebook.
What happens next? Has Facebook made any new commitments to address the demands made by advertisers and civil rights groups? What explanations are they giving?
Facebook is putting out a flurry of blog posts and responses, especially now that it seems like that meeting did not go as well as they had hoped. So now they're kind of trying to put out more responses and say, no, we are doing some stuff. They have agreed to hire a civil rights position, but they are still kind of up in the air on these other requests. Mark Zuckerberg will be testifying before Congress at the end of the month, but that is not part of this issue. It's part of an antitrust hearing along with Google, Apple, and Amazon. And they're getting it internally, too. There has been a Facebook internal employee virtual walkout. So they are not just getting criticism from outside the company, but from within its own employees.
Omar Gayaga keeps an eye on the tech world at TechMinuteTexas.com. Thanks so much, Omar.
Thanks for having me, David. Have a good week.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas executed an inmate last night for a crime he committed when he was 18. Billy Joe Wardlow died by lethal injection for fatally shooting Carl Cole during a robbery in 1993. Several sheriff's departments in Texas are raising concerns about how to enforce the governor's statewide mask order because it bars them from detaining, arresting, or jailing people who don't comply. Nacogdoches County Sheriff Jason Bridges says his agency in rural East Texas is encouraging people to wear face masks and making sure they know they're required.
We understand that times are hard, people out of jobs, and they probably don't need a $250 ticket. We believe that going out and reminding citizens of what this order is for those that we find in violation, because again, it is at our discretion. If we remind our law-abiding citizens what the order is, that they will comply with that order.
Bridges says citations will be issued to repeat of violators. Nearly 4 years after Dallas police officers pinned a 32-year-old man face down on the ground, ultimately killing him, a federal judge has cleared them of using excessive force. Tony Tempa called 911 in August of 2016 to ask for help after running through traffic barefoot. Tempa told the dispatcher he was currently off his medication for anxiety and schizophrenia. He had also used cocaine. Dallas Morning News reporter Kevin Krause is covering the case. He says one of the officers knelt on Tempa's back for 14 minutes.
And so with the officers on top of him and trying to restrain him and handcuffing him, unfortunately that led to his death, according to the medical examiner.
The judge said his decision to dismiss the charges was based on qualified immunity, which requires Tempa's family to cite a case from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals that deems the officer's conduct illegal.
It's a very high burden that the plaintiffs have to meet to show that the conduct is unconstitutional.
Tempa's family plans to appeal the ruling. And San Antonio Spurs guard Patty Mills plans to donate the salary he's earning during the 8 games of the NBA's restart in Florida to social justice groups. Mills will contribute over $1 million to Black Lives Matter Australia, Back Black Deaths in Custody, and the We Got You campaign, which works to end racism in sports in Australia.
So I'm playing in Orlando because I don't want to leave any money on the table that could be going directly to black communities.
The Spurs head to Orlando today. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
As communities grapple with the coronavirus pandemic, new developments unfold continuously. Catch up on the day's news from around the world and across Texas by listening to All Things Considered, weekday afternoons on your local NPR station.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. When the COVID-19 pandemic first began to take hold in Texas, it was the major metro areas first to see rapid rises. Rural areas with lower population densities, less travel generally, seen as more insulated, at least at first, from the virus's spread. But those rural parts of Texas have not been spared the effects of the pandemic. In Titus County, population 32,000, the rate of infection has been rising dramatically, exceeding much of the rest of the Lone Star State. In fact, latest figures from the Department of State Health Services puts the rate of infection there at 25 cases per 1,000 persons. By comparison, the overall infection rate in Texas is about 7 per 1,000. Joining us now is Terry Scoggin. He's CEO of Titus Regional Medical Center in Mount Pleasant. Mr. Scoggin, what has been the trajectory of the pandemic in your area? Have you seen a steady increase, or was there a moment when cases just seemed to take off?
Well, David, thank you for the opportunity to talk about Titus County in Northeast Texas. In the very beginning, we were slow, like the rest of the rural hospitals in the state of Texas. But in May, our clusters and increase of the infection in Titus County hit our peak, and it rose dramatically through the whole month of May. And then at the end of May, it dropped and we started going down. And then over the last 2 weeks, we've seen a dramatic increase where we're starting to rise again. And as of this morning, we're increasing our census in the hospital, and our ICU is full this morning. And we're increasingly seeing the number of positives on a daily basis back to where we were in May.
What do you think is leading to higher rates in your area?
Well, we're in Northeast Texas. We're 60 miles from the Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Louisiana border, so we're right in the middle. We support 5 counties, about 82,000 people for our hospital district. We are a rural independent hospital, the last one left in Northeast Texas. We've had closures in our area, so we support a wide variety of different counties and demographics. Our county is 42% Hispanic. We are large, rural, agricultural, and industrial. We do have a meat processing plant in our town, but right now it's community spread. And I think one of the things that's driving that right now is the increase is just, we have a lack of primary care. We have lack of resources throughout the community. So we're seeing that increase on a consistent basis.
You mentioned that your ICU beds are completely taken. That's got to be an enormous challenge you face as a rural healthcare provider. What do you do?
Well, first of all, our physicians and our nurses have been phenomenal. And our team and our doctors have collaborated with our administration and our nursing staff from day one to come up with protocols and policies to handle it. So we were ready for it. We were ready for the first in May when this happened, and we're ready this time. It's stretching everything we do. We've worked closely with our partners in Tyler, Longview, Texarkana, and Dallas. We try and keep as many patients as we can and try and find places for the ones for the very, very sick.
Well, what sort of additional support or resources would you like to see to help your hospital and your community tackle this outbreak? Is there anything that's missing that could be there if people would take notice?
Well, the biggest thing is we're continuing to encourage our population, our counties, to wear masks. We have a large Medicare population, a large uninsured population, 31% of our counties adult uninsured, which is way ahead of the state's average. Our unemployment rate is great. We're very low. The problem is a lot of them are not high-paying jobs, so a lot of people don't have insurance. But from a resource standpoint, it's testing. We don't have asymptomatic testing at this point. Somebody says, Terry, I'm going to be tested. We don't have the resources. We're testing about 125 a day, but those are for people with symptoms. Our infection rate right now is about 30 to 32% over the last 7 days of the people we test. The other one is remdesivir. You know, that's the magic medicine right now that it's being allocated at the federal level down to the state. We got a shipment of 40 vials a few weeks ago, and it saved people's lives. But right now we're down to 6 vials. So without that, we can't keep some of those sicker patients. We'll have to transfer.
Boy, the emotional impact has got to be enormous in a community the size of yours.
It's up and down like this. And I mean, over the last few weeks, we started getting better. And then when the state started increasing last week, we started increasing as well. We've had 24 employees test positive. We've had 2 of our employees who are very sick. One of our employees, who's a friend in a rural community of 800 employees, they're all friends. You know what I mean? We know each other. We go to church together. I did have one of our team members pass away with COVID. So in a rural community, when, you know, it's, we've done a great job of keeping our mortality rate low. We've only had 5 deaths in our county, but we did lose a team member. That was emotional. And we had a team member come back. 2 team members got sick about the same day, 133, 158, both on the ventilators for 2 weeks. The 33-year-old came back to work last week. The 58-year-old passed away. So it's real. So anybody who argues with you and tells you that people are making up numbers or this stuff, I can look them in the eye and say, this is real, and I've seen what the impacts of this will do.
Terry Scoggin is CEO of Titus Regional Medical Center in Mount Pleasant, Texas, in the northeastern part of Texas. Mr. Scoggin, thanks again for your time.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Nationwide, about 62% of the 2020 census surveys have been returned so far. In Texas, however, the response is much lower. New numbers from the Census Bureau show a response rate of less than 57% in Texas, making Texas 40th best in the United States. Here to tell us more about what's behind all this is Lila Valencia. She is a senior demographer at the Texas Demographic Center. Lila, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
What are some of the factors behind Texas's low response rate for the 2020 census?
Well, we always knew it was going to be difficult to count a state as large, as diverse as Texas. And then, of course, things changed for all of us. And COVID-19 and the pandemic has really changed things drastically.
Of course, COVID is affecting all states, and Texas has always been big. I'm wondering if there's not some other factor going on here. I mean, ranked 40th among the 50 states. That's pretty surprising, at least to me.
The challenges are the people of Texas. We have a lot of very diverse populations. We have a lot of multi-generational households. We have a lot of children. We have a lot of people of color. We just saw our latest estimates from the Census Bureau show that Hispanics are adding more people, more than 50% of the total population increase in the state since 2010. And so we have a higher share of what are called hard-to-count populations. And we also have a large rural population, which really heard from the Census Bureau for the first time in late May, early June.
You talk about the demographic diversity and the large number of people of color, and that number is growing, of course, as we speak. Why would they be a greater challenge to count?
Well, there are a lot of factors that contribute to whether a person is likely to count or respond to the 2020 census or not. And when we've been looking at the data, things like internet access are really positively correlated with response. Now, internet access is, you know, much more available now, but the communities that still have lower access to internet continue to be communities of color. Mm. We also find a negative correlation between poverty and people who live right above poverty and response rates to the census. And so we know that, again, the people, the communities with the higher poverty rates are Hispanic communities and African American communities.
Something we haven't touched on, I know we should, is what the price might be for Texas if we don't get an accurate count.
Sure. Right now, we see projections that estimate over 500,000 Texans that might be undercounted in the 2020 census. And the cost, unfortunately, is that if we just have an undercount of just 1% of the population, Texas is at risk of losing over $300 million per year for the next 10 years, all for resources that go to funding things like schools, roads, parks, and emergency response that is highly needed during this time.
Any reason for optimism that these numbers might improve or rebound?
Unfortunately, a lot of the things that we know are effective, reaching out to people through trusted voices like churches and schools and public libraries, all of those places closed down. And we know that response rate in certain areas of the state, for instance, in the Rio Grande Valley, really rely on that face-to-face interaction with that trusted voice. The Census Bureau is starting to go out into communities in a safe way, in a socially distant way, and we are really hopeful that those efforts will result in increases.
Lila Valencia is a senior demographer at the Texas Demographic Center. Lila, thanks so much for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Calls to defund the police may have started in the streets, but the voices of protesters demanding an end to police brutality have been resonating in Dallas City Hall. So reports KERA's Hadi Mawagdi, who talked with members of the Dallas City Council and heard about ways they're considering using some of the Dallas Police Department's $514 million budget differently.
Since the death of George Floyd, there have been a lot of Dallasites wanting to speak at the city council's virtual meetings, and many have the same idea.
I'm calling to demand the city reevaluate, divest, and defund DPD.
We refuse to fund the murder, incarceration, detention, and deportations of our brothers, sons, and fathers any longer.
We cannot keep funding a police department that has been proven ineffective and insufficient.
That was Kelly Barrett, Jennifer Cortez, and Jennifer Ibarra during the public comment period of a city council meeting last month about the city's next budget. The draft's due in August, and it'll go into effect in October. Dallas Mayor Eric Johnson says,
I am not in favor at all of getting rid of the Dallas Police Department.
The mayor wasn't available to comment for this story, but Johnson talked about it with Dallas's Fox affiliate recently. He says what he is open to is moving money around.
That's a conversation that I'm not only willing to have, but fully expected to have in any case. That's what we do around the horseshoe every year when we talk about the budget.
Recently, 10 of the city's 14 council members sent a memo to City Manager T.C. Broadnax requesting he draft a budget that shifts some of DPD money to departments providing social services.
We need to listen to what people in the city of Dallas are saying.
Councilman Casey Thomas represents Southwest Dallas.
And we need to listen to this worldwide cry and call.
He thinks now is the time to reimagine public safety. For one, he wants to vastly expand a program that sends behavioral health specialists with police responding to mental health calls.
The medical professional who's trained in knowing how to deal with these mental health episodes can provide ways to de-escalate that situation.
Thomas also wants to grant more power to the Community Police Oversight Board. But activists like Mercedes Fulbright say police unions in Dallas are too strong for an oversight board to have any real impact.
It's not preventing the violence and terror and murders and kidnappings that are happening from that institution. You know, we're like, y'all, like, this isn't working. And we got to stop lying and gaslighting our people on this thought that, like, we can make it better.
Fulbright's an organizer for a coalition called In Defense of Black Lives. They've got an online petition with 22,000 signatures calling on Dallas's leaders to, quote, end the war on black people, depopulate jails and prisons, and to divest from DPD.
I can't believe they're still paying for tactical gear or tear gas or those rubber bullets that they used against us in the streets. Like, that could have went to, you know, the kids who are at home right now who don't have food in their pantries, right?
Fulbright wants the city's next budget to spend less on policing and more on things like education, medical care, and housing. North Dallas City Councilman Lee Kleinman doesn't want to see the city's police force shrink. But he thinks the Dallas Police Academy is one big place for cuts.
I would propose that we don't even have an academy.
That could save the city $24 million. Kleinman says police unions have always said Dallas needs an academy to train cadets the Dallas way. But he argues recruits could be trained through existing law enforcement programs at Eastfield College or Tarrant County College.
Those are professional academic institutions that are accredited with instructors. You don't get that bias that's built into our system from the first year that they come on.
Kleinman has other ideas too. But for now, while the city's budget is still being discussed, he thinks protesters and activists should review the current budget, find items that they want eliminated, and then push for that. Because he says screaming to defund the police won't do enough to make a real change. I'm Hadi Mawagdi in Dallas.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It is a phrase often repeated, especially, every 2 years or so when folks head to the polls. Could this be the year Texas turns blue? Texas has been solidly red for a long time. In fact, the Lone Star State hasn't favored a Democrat for president since 1976. 2020 and recent polls have political insiders once again asking, could this be the year? Well, if you ask one longtime Texas political insider, the answer might be yes. Mark McKinnon, who many Texans know as having worked for politicians including Lloyd Doggett, Ann Richards, Bob Bullock, and George W. Bush, is currently the co-creator, co-executive producer, and co-host of Showtime's The Circus. And he joins us now. Mark, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Always glad to be talking to Texas. Thanks. How you doing?
Doing just fine. Your latest article in Vanity Fair caught our attention. Democrats' Blue Texas Fever Dream may finally become a reality. So I guess the first question goes to organizational power. Do Texas Democrats have the organization in Texas to turn out voters for Biden beyond the big cities where they're already in power?
Well, they've done a much better job, and people like Beto O'Rourke are doing a really good job helping organize. I think Democrats have really done a terrific job over the last couple of cycles of energizing their base. Will Texas turn blue? Listen, I don't think it's a probable, but it's possible. I've been around a long time, and every 2 years, as you said, everybody raises this specter of the blue wave coming to Texas. But I'm cautious. I remember when Texas was a two-party state. It was you're a conservative Democrat or a liberal Democrat. There was no Republican Party in 1990 when I worked for Ann Richards. All 28 elected statewide offices were Democrats, but 8 years later, after George Bush came to town and attracted independents and conservative Democrats like me to cross the line, all 28 were Republicans. So Texas is a naturally conservative state, and once there was a Republican alternative, a lot of people chose that option. So I think people should be wary, but it's an opportunity, and Donald Trump is clearly clawing his way to the bottom right now, which creates the potential for a huge historic wave election, which means that Texas could be part of it. My advice, though, to Democrats, particularly national Democrats, is keep your eye on the prize. You know, you want 270 electoral votes. If you're winning Texas, that means you're winning a lot of states you shouldn't be winning, and you're probably winning north of maybe 400 electoral votes. So don't spend a lot of money in Texas. Spend your money in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Florida, Arizona, North Carolina, those states that are really key swing states.
Do you think that there are enough so-called mainstream conservatives who will feel that they can or choose Biden over Trump in Texas? Because that seems to be what it comes down to. In fact, a lot of people are pointing to the suburbs right now.
Sure, I think it's possible. That's the reason that Joe Biden has been such a challenge for Donald Trump, at least so far, is that he's a very safe alternative. He's not a scary Bernie Sanders socialist type. Texas Republicans, particularly those who've kind of changed parties over the years and are fairly, moderate Republicans, see Biden as a reasonable choice. These are people who really could just kind of look at it and say, do I really want 4 more years of chaos of the way we've seen, or, relative stability with Biden, a guy who's been there, is familiar. I think a lot of Republicans could make that choice.
What about the COVID factor? Is that in play here? I'm curious as to why you think there might be the number of defections that it could take, in fact, to make Texas swing for Joe Biden.
There's no question there's a COVID factor. I mean, Donald Trump ran as a disruptor, and he did it very successfully. He's one of the Hall of Fame candidates who ran as an outsider. That's tough to do as an incumbent when you have the responsibility for keeping the country safe and healthy. And people right now don't feel healthy at all, and they're worried about COVID. And it's not getting better. It's getting worse. Texas has got not a good record right now about, trying to open too early. And that, was that from pressure from the president to do so? So people are worried, and when they're worried, that's not good for the incumbent president. In fact, what we're seeing now is a lot of down ballot people, a lot of Senate candidates around the country starting to break from Trump, which is a very bad sign. Those are canaries in the coal mine.
Mark McKinnon is co-executive producer and co-host of Showtime's The Circus. You can read all about his latest in Vanity Fair over at TexasStandard.org, where we'll have a link. Mark, thanks again.
Hey, kick it hard, carry on regardless. Thank you for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Michael Marks is in for Wells Dunbar, monitoring social media on this Thursday. Howdy, Michael.
Hey, David. Been a busy morning.
It sure has. Wow.
Yeah. A little bit of news popping up here and there, including a piece that we didn't quite have room for the show, except just now, a news breaking program, David, from the U.S. Supreme Court, High Court, deciding that President Trump must release financial records subpoenaed by prosecutors in New York. The justices said that the president has no categorical immunity when it comes to releasing or withholding financial records. They did so in a 7-2 decision, no less, worth noting that both of the president's appointees siding with the majority. Just to be clear on the upshot of this ruling, though, David, Nicole LeBlanc notes on our Facebook page, both tax cases are remanded to lower courts for further argument, taking into account the court's opinions. We won't see any Trump tax returns before the election. So,
and
like
yeah,
you said,
that's an important that's an important qualification, and we should mention that second case that the poster is referring to had to do with the president trying to keep his tax records away from Congress. Apparently, he can now block the release of those financial records to Congress, but it's the one to the prosecutors in New York who are allowed to see them pending the lower court's actions, of course.
That's true. And as UT law professor and friend of the show Steve Vladek says on Twitter, yes, the court rejected Trump's categorical arguments in both New York and congressional subpoena cases, but neither ruling means subpoenas will be enforced anytime soon. Too much remains to be resolved on remand and then repeal. Now, this is the case getting the bulk of the media attention this morning, David, but it was not the only one on which the Supreme Court ruled today. Let me bring up another one real quick that's hugely important for our neighbors to the north. That's McGirt versus Oklahoma. So in this case, the justices ruled that since much of the eastern half of Oklahoma was set aside as a Native American reservation in the 19th century, that the Muscogee Creek people should still have jurisdiction over that land, not state authorities.
This is huge, by the way.
It's enormous.
I mean, this is a 5-4 decision that will really reshape criminal justice in all, nearly half of Oklahoma.
That's correct. A lot to sort out here. It doesn't mean that land ownership will be nullified or anything like that, but it could mean, there are a lot of questions regarding Native people who were convicted of crimes by the state of Oklahoma or some other jurisdiction in the eastern part of the state, and also what it means for other tribes who have signed treaties that were not honored, which is quite a few of them, David.
This and many other stories making news on this Thursday. You can keep up with everything over at TexasStandard.org. We're out of time for the broadcast, and we'd love to hear from you. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Till tomorrow, I'm David Brown, along with the rest of the Texas Standard team, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.